among the orphan population due to tainted and often medically unnecessary blood transfusions. British journalist Bob Graham was an eyewitness to the rooms in which the children were raised. In addition to the pervasive stink of urine, it was the silence that he found most disturbing. Usually when you enter a room packed with cots filled with children, the expectation is of noise, chatter, or crying, sometimes even a whimper. There was none, even though the children were awake. They lay in their cots, sometimes two to each cot, sometimes three, their eyes staring silently. It was eerie, almost sinister. They were inhuman. Stalls were children, babies, were treated like farm animals. No, I'm wrong. At least the animals felt brave enough to make a noise. In 1984, Ceausescu personally laid the cornerstone for the People's House, a gargantuan edifice meant to have approximately 5 times the square footage of Versailles. It was to become the heaviest building on earth, and though it was supposedly built for the Romanian people, it would serve the Ceausescus as the largest palace that had ever been constructed. Both the military and ordinary citizens were drafted to assist in its construction, while hundreds of citizens literally froze to death every year in the Romanian winter. Many others died from asphyxiation due to turning on their stoves to provide heat, having the gas go out, and then having it come back on unlit. Eventually, construction costs for the People's House were roughly the same as Romania's entire welfare budget. Ceausescu's holier-than-thou attitude increased over time as he began to believe all the nonsensical propaganda fed to the Romanian people about his greatness. Gorbachev observed that anyone with the slightest political experience could see his delusions of grandeur as well as his psychological instability. The Soviet leader was not alone in his impressions of the man that the Romanian media referred to by such titles as the living fire, the treasure of wisdom and charisma, or even the new morning star. As Gorbachev put it, I've encountered many ambitious people in my life. Indeed, it is hard to imagine a major politician without his share of vanity and self-confidence. In this sense, though, Ceausescu was in a class of his own. An absolute ruler for decades, he always wore an arrogant smirk, treating others with apparent contempt, everyone from retainers to equal partners. Ceausescu did his best to keep Romanians unaware of the changes that Gorbachev was implementing in the Soviet Union. When Gorbachev visited Bucharest in 1987, he attempted to get Ceausescu to open his country to the outside world. Ceausescu thought this would be disastrous, both for communism and himself. Their arguments degenerated into shouting. Doors and windows were shut to make sure that no one could hear what was transpiring between the two leaders. Ceausescu insisted on doubling down even when there was reason to relax his oppressive measures. In April 1989, about a week after the announcement of Poland's Roundtable Agreement, Ceausescu had a major announcement of his own. On the one hand, he proclaimed, Romania's foreign debt had now been paid off and months ahead of schedule. On the other hand, the crippling rationing and lack of electricity would nevertheless continue. But now that the Soviet Union had a much better relationship with the West, there was virtually no reason for Western countries to court Ceausescu as an antagonistic force against the USSR. The situation for the Romanian people seemed to be completely hopeless. The month after Ceausescu's announcement saw elections being held in East Germany. Though it was certain that the Communist Party would win everything, there was still a mechanism for courageous citizens to register their defiance. All they had to do was take their ballot and, instead of placing it in the ballot box by the entrance, walk across the room in front of the police into a secret booth. Their names would, of course, be taken down, and the Stasi would naturally follow up with such dissidents. The number who chose to undertake this quiet act of defiance never amounted to more than a small percentage of the population. In 1989, however, things were a bit different. Several priests and a few activists who were tolerated by the government insisted on their constitutional right to watch the votes being cast. The authorities agreed, knowing that there was absolutely no possibility of them losing the election. Indeed, when the results came in, the communists announced that they had been returned to office with 98.6% of the vote. The poll watchers, however, announced that that number was a fraud, that the number of protest votes was somewhere between 9 and 10%. This still would have resulted in a 90% vote for the communists. They were lying even when it was unnecessary, and the West Germans made big news about this information. Worse, the East German authorities could do little to prevent their citizens from watching those newscasts or coming to realize just how many of their countrymen were displeased with the government. This was the backdrop to the Polish elections on June 4, 1989. The communists had insisted on a swift vote after their agreement with Solidarity, hoping that this would reestablish their role as Poland's natural leaders and relegate the labor movement to an impotent parliamentary opposition force. The Polish voting process was counterintuitive, with voters having to cross out the names of candidates they did not want rather than merely choose the ones that they did. An enormous percentage of the population reveled in finally having the opportunity to cross out the names of those communist officials that they despised. The final result in Poland was almost a perfect inversion of the East German vote. There were 35 seats up for election in the lower house of parliament. Solidarity won 33 of them in the first round of voting. In the Senate, all 100 seats were up for election. Solidarity won 99 of them. The prime minister, interior minister, and defense minister, who had threatened to resign if the party did not support General Jaruzelski, now had no choice but to leave, since all three were voted out of office. But would the Polish United Workers' Party honor the results and seat the opposition? As amazing as it sounds, the unprecedented election where a nation democratically voted out their Communist Party wasn't even the biggest worldwide news that day. That was because June 4th, 1989 is remembered for a far more ominous event, the Tiananmen Square Massacre. For weeks, protests against the government had spread throughout China, largely fueled by students and other young people. A huge number of protesters occupied Beijing's Tiananmen Square, site of Mao's mausoleum where, much like Lenin in Moscow, the communist leader lay embalmed on display for visitors to come pay their respects. The dissidents constructed a 33-foot-high statue of the goddess of democracy out of foam and papier-mâché to symbolize their aspirations for a free, democratic China. Those aspirations would soon be quashed. On the night of June 3rd and into the morning of June 4th, Chinese officials had had enough. They sent in the tanks. The Chinese government managed to do a good job of keeping international observers from getting footage of the massacre itself. It remains unclear how many were slaughtered by the government. Hundreds? Thousands? Yet the most enduring image of the Tiananmen Square massacre was that of the individual who came to be dubbed Tank Man. A lone man whose name and fate remain unknown stood in the middle of Chang'an Avenue the day after the Chinese government killed its protesting citizens. Holding a shopping bag in his hand, he forced the tanks leaving Tiananmen Square to halt before he was eventually whisked away by God knows who to God knows where. He remains a worldwide symbol of the power, or even the duty, of the average individual to defy the forces of authoritarianism. Internationally, the reaction to Tiananmen Square was largely that of horror and sadness. In Poland specifically, there was great concern that Jaruzelski would once again declare martial law. Senior Solidarity figure Bronislav Geremek expressed the concerns of many, for we knew we had won, but we also knew they had all the guns. Yet this was Poland, not China. Communications between Warsaw and Moscow demonstrated to the Polish government that there was no appetite in the Soviet leadership for using force against the voters. Journalist Timothy Garton-Ash was eyewitness to the events, and as he described it, three things happened at once. The communists lost an election, Solidarity won, the communists acknowledged that Solidarity won. That might sound like a syllogism, yet until almost the day before, anyone who had predicted these events would have been universally considered not a logician, but a lunatic. The Polish authorities decided to put their faith in the electorate again to try and win the presidency when the Polish parliament convened in a few weeks' time. The East German government had a different take on the Chinese massacre, with news programs repeatedly playing their authorities' congratulations to the Chinese government for its prompt action in dealing with disturbances in Beijing that were instigated by Western imperialist agents. East German citizens got the message all too well. As a result of this, many East Germans who were taking vacations in Hungary decided against going back. One after another, they also began driving their Trabi automobiles to Budapest. The plan was to somehow eventually make their way via Austria to West German soil, whereas Germans, they would gain citizenship automatically. In the same way that citizens had vanished in the old Soviet Union, now the East Germans couldn't help but notice how many people were quietly disappearing one by one. The East German authorities asked the Hungarians to return their citizens to them. Despite their early assurances when they had torn down the border between Austria and Hungary, now the Hungarian authorities explicitly refused to repatriate those East Germans within their borders. Rather than looking at them as predominantly citizens of the German Democratic Republic, Hungary now regarded them as refugees, and by this point there were a lot of them, around 85,000. Honecker was apoplectic, and even more so when the Russians refused to get involved. He was told that he would somehow have to settle matters with the Hungarians by himself. This was not Honecker's only problem. Matters in neighboring Poland were also proceeding rapidly. In Lech Walesa's view, electing Jaruzelski as president would grant the Polish transition international legitimacy and would allow both the United States and the Soviet Union to endorse the new government. Many members of Solidarity were aghast at his plan and refused to endorse the man who had cracked down and imprisoned them. The Soviets still had thousands of troops in Poland, and it was very easy to envision a European Tiananmen Square. Eventually, a compromise was reached. Jaruzelski was elected president with some support from Solidarity. Conversely, Solidarity was permitted to form a government with some support from the communists. Hungary swiftly followed suit. The previous year, activists had tried to commemorate the anniversary of Imre Nagy's murder before being violently suppressed by the police. A year later, Gorbachev had personally assured both the Hungarian Prime Minister and the General Secretary of the Hungarian Socialist Workers' Party that the Soviet Union was no longer in favor of using force to impose its will on Hungary. Something else had happened. A promise from the Hungarian government to allow the exhumation, identification, and reburial of Nagy's remains, which had been long hidden, in order to keep his grave from becoming a shrine. The government's official position on the events of 1956 changed as well. It was no longer referred to as a counter-revolution, but instead as a popular uprising. So it was that on June 16, 1989, Nagy and his four closest associates finally got an official funeral, with a sixth coffin alongside theirs to represent the unknown insurgent, all the other Hungarians, many anonymous, who gave their lives in a failed attempt to liberate their country from Soviet rule. Audio of one of Nagy's speeches was blasted over the loudspeakers at Hero Square in Budapest. Roughly 200,000 Hungarians came out to pay their respects, laying flowers on top of the coffins of those who had given all. The day's star was Viktor Orban, spokesman of the Alliance of Young Democrats, better known as Fidesz. Orban felt safe enough to say what would have been unspeakable mere months prior. If we can trust our souls and strength, we can put an end to the communist dictatorship. If we are determined enough, we can force the party to submit itself to free elections. And if we do not lose sight of the ideals of 1956, then we will be able to elect a government that will start immediate negotiations for the swift withdrawal of Russian troops. Orban was correct. 10 days after Nagy's funeral, Gross ceded power to Presidium of himself and three other men. The dam broke swiftly and decisively for the most liberal of the Warsaw Pact nations. Honecker and Ceausescu were beside themselves, demanding that Gorbachev intervene in both Poland and Hungary. Gorbachev's answer was unambiguous, telling them that those who were afraid had better hold on because perestroika has only just begun. He particularly didn't care about the Romanian leader's concerns, dismissively telling his aides that Ceausescu's just worried for his own skin. Honecker could do nothing, for his own life was in the balance. He was in Romania on July 8, 1989 for the annual Warsaw Pact Leadership Summit. After he gave a predictable speech about the dangers facing communism, he grabbed his side and collapsed in extreme pain. The Bucharest hospital's preliminary diagnosis of gallstones was reevaluated by Berlin doctors when Honecker returned home. He had gallbladder cancer. The ultra-centralized East German government was effectively silenced as Honecker recuperated and GDR officials sat on their hands as matters escalated out of their control. No one wanted to assume responsibility, which would be seen as undermining Honecker's leadership in a country where the official line was, as it always was, that everything is fine. Hungary then went full throttle on liberalization in other ways. Hungary's reformist Minister of State, Imre Pozgai, teamed up with Franz Joseph Otto Robert Maria Anton Karl Marx Heinrich Sixtus Xavier Felix Renatus Ludwig Gaten Pius Ignatius von Habsburg-Lorraine, better known as Otto von Habsburg, last Crown Prince of Austria-Hungary, to promote a pan-European picnic. The border between Austria and Hungary would be temporarily opened on the afternoon of August 19, 1989, near the town of Sopron, exactly where the electrified fencing between the two nations had been taken down. A ceremonial gate would be constructed and its doors opened, with delegations from both countries then crossing the border in a demonstration of support for freedom of movement. Word got out to the refugee community to make their way to Sopron, and both the Austrian Red Cross and the Austrian authorities made preparations to receive an influx of East Germans. Behind the scenes, the Hungarian authorities quietly told their border guards to stand down should any refugee attempt to cross over into Austria on that day. The head of the border guard explicitly told his officers to simply order refugees to turn back, but to do absolutely nothing to prevent them from doing so. Around 2,000 refugees crossed from Hungary into Austria that day, all in disbelief that this wasn't all some big trick. The East Germans remaining in Budapest began to mob the West German consulate in order to get West German passports. Refugee centers were set up throughout Hungary to service the needs of those East Germans making their way west. The GDR demanded to send planes and trains to repatriate the refugees, but the requests were immediately dismissed by Hungarian officials. They compromised on allowing diplomatic observers from East Germany to monitor the situation, all of whom turned out to be Stasi. When a Stasi officer demanded to know the names of everyone going in and out of one of the centers, he was refused. Then the Stasi stationed a van outside one center and instead began to photograph everyone who came and went. A Hungarian mob gathered and began to stone the van. The next night it was vandalized, and the night after that it was gone. After a certain point, the East German authorities could no longer ignore the number of missing people, not entirely. The refugees were then publicly denounced as either political illiterates or criminals, but no one listened. The contrary news reports about the refugees from the West were incessant, and word about their fate swiftly spread through the GDR. By and large, what mattered to the East Germans was how their former countrymen were being treated and whether they themselves should risk everything in what came to be known as the Exodus. East German Foreign Minister Oskar Fischer met with Soviet Foreign Minister and firm Gorbachev ally Eduard Shevardnadze. Now, instead of the USSR remaining noncommittal, Shevardnadze sided with the refugees explicitly. He encouraged the GDR to allow for emigration, telling Fischer that it will not be bad and will ease your economic burdens. Matters in Poland reached their culmination that same month. Though 65% of the parliamentary seats had been allocated to the communists, that number included a significant amount of seats set aside for the rural United People's Party and the Alliance of Democrats, which were both communist satellite parties. As in several other nations, historically such parties were impotent and existed at the discretion of the main communist party in order to grant the appearance of an air of opposition. Now, however, the two parties that had been oppositional on paper became oppositional in reality. No longer under the thumb of the Polish United Workers' Party, Walesa persuaded them them to switch their allegiances to side with Solidarity. In one fell swoop, President Jaruzelski lost his majority even on paper. It remained Jaruzelski's role to choose the new prime minister from a list of three candidates suggested by Walesa and Solidarity. He was comfortable with the choice of Solidarity leader Tadeusz Mazowiecki, who assumed office on August 24, 1989. Within less than a year, the communists went from controlling every aspect of Polish society, having all the parliamentary seats and all the guns, to non-existence, with the Polish United Workers' Party officially dissolving itself in January of 1990. By the end of 1990, Jaruzelski resigned from the presidency and officially handed the office over to Lech Walesa. The communists never again regained a foothold on power in Poland. Hungary's version of the roundtable talks were held around a triangular table, but the results were even more dramatic than what had happened in Poland. The Hungarian agreements resulted in free elections open to all parties with no set-asides for the communists, as well as massive political liberalization. The ruling Hungarian Socialist Workers' Party rebranded itself as the Hungarian Socialist Party, eventually becoming the main center-left party in Hungarian politics. By 1998, Orbán would be elected prime minister at the age of 35. After leaving office upon the completion of his first term, he would return to lead his Fidesz party to four more parliamentary victories from 2010 through 2022. To paraphrase Ernest Hemingway, the Poles and the Hungarians were thus liberated in two ways, gradually, then suddenly. But they were not the only ones. Chapter 15, Die Hard. Domino theory was used to justify the United States entering what became the Vietnam War. The idea was that if one country became communist, then communist forces would overrun neighboring countries like a series of falling dominoes. It didn't seem to enter the heads of American experts that the reverse could occur as well. On August 25, 1989, the day after Tadeusz Mazowiecki became Poland's prime minister, Hungarian Prime Minister Miklós Németh secretly flew to the West German capital of Bonn to meet with West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Németh did not waste time with pleasantries. "We have decided to allow the GDR citizens to leave freely, mainly on humanitarian grounds," he informed Kohl. "It seems you may have to deal with 100,000 or even 150,000 new citizens arriving very quickly." The West Germans were skeptical. They were happy to keep the matter quiet from the East Germans. The propaganda appeal could not be overstated. Here was absolute proof that, given the choice, the people of Germany preferred the liberal West to the communist East, to the point of leaving behind all of their belongings and risking their lives. That left the elephant in the room, the Soviet Union. Did the Russians know? How would they react? Though Kohl had been the first to know, Németh assured him that Gorbachev would not interfere. And if Honecker refused to allow the East Germans to head west, as he most certainly would, then Németh was prepared to suspend Hungary's travel agreement with the GDR. Kohl wasn't taking any chances. He had been drafted by the Nazis at the age of 15, right as World War II was drawing to a close. Though he had avoided combat, he still remembered the devastation that the Russian forces had inflicted on Germany. Kohl phoned Gorbachev to be sure that there would be no escalation of tensions between the two nations. According to Kohl, all Gorbachev told him was that the Hungarians are good people. It was the Soviet leader's tacit endorsement of everything that was going on. Now they just had to let the East Germans know. While Honecker recuperated, the Hungarians told East Germany's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Oskar Fischer, that they intend to let all the refugees who wanted to leave for the West. "That's treachery," Fischer said. "This will have grave consequences for you." He insisted that if the refugees returned to the GDR, that they would not be punished, but the Hungarians did not believe this, nor, more importantly, did the refugees. The East Germans were livid. They wrote to Budapest and they wrote to Moscow. They tried to rally all the Warsaw Pact leaders to descend on Hungary and force the government to submit, but the Poles said no and the Russians were uninterested. "Hungary is betraying socialism," fumed the head of the Stasi, not entirely incorrectly, but there was nothing he could do about it. On September 10, 1989, all border controls were lifted in Hungary. Within 3 days, over 18,000 East Germans made their way west, assisted by buses helpfully provided by the West German government. Things did not go unnoticed in East Germany. It was immediately clear that a crack had formed in the totalitarian power of the GDR's regime, and the East German population intended to make the most of it. On September 11th, the day after Hungary opened its border, an organization called New Forum was founded in the GDR in hopes of achieving dialogue with the government. It was instantly found to be illegal, but that didn't matter. A few days later, over 150,000 East Germans did the unprecedented and publicly signed their names to a petition calling for talks with the state. That same month, demonstrations began to loosely coalesce in Leipzig, East Germany's second largest city. The community had been succumbing to filth and pollution as factories spewed smoke into the atmosphere as the population gradually fled to seek refuge elsewhere. Meeting at the 800-year-old St. Nicholas Church, protesters lit candles every Monday evening and began to march. Soon thousands joined, if only because there was so little else for them to do, claiming that the Chinese comrades must be lauded because they were able to smother the protest